auf ihrem Weg zum Horizont. Denkst du vielleicht gerade an mich? Dann singe ich ein Lied für dich von 99 Luftballons. Und das war's von so.
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Hello, this is Ashley Ross, and welcome to the latest episode of Sound is Not a Language. For this recording, on January 31st, I'm coming to you from the opening of a solo exhibition, Chinwaza Rebehavior, by none other than our very own MFA cohort, Annie Chen. Before I get to the sounds of the opening reception, let's first talk about the charcuterie board. A lot of galleries and institutions don't understand that sometimes an opening reception is made by how good the food and drinks are. I'm being dead serious. And as a grad student, especially an art grad student, this is basically dinner. So I appreciated the attention to detail with the delicious selection of fruits, which included pineapples, melons, grapes, and strawberries. The meats and cheeses were of great quality as well. But let's talk about the most important part of the show, which is Annie's show. You can tell from how intricate some of the pieces are that there is an incredible amount of thought and research and investigation that goes into her practice and specifically the pieces. Also, experiencing her work outside of CMU has me appreciating her approach to her art practice even more. I love how, although her work considers colonization and migration through various methods of travel and experience, she's also considering and challenging the viewer to consider context and the environment. Her work never feels like she just slaps something together and calls it a day. She's constantly questioning, learning, and experimenting. And she takes the time to really understand what she's working with, and it shows. And so I'm super excited that we all got to go and experience Annie's show in person and have a good time and support, you know, building careers specifically within an MFA program. And it's exciting to see that somebody already has a solo show in the first year. So enjoy the sounds of an opening reception. I got to interview a few people. Enjoy. Congrats, Annie. Well, how do you feel? It looks beautiful.
Thank you very much. This is the one you made. Yeah, I love that one. Okay. Yeah, I want to do that.
Oh, in Annie's cohort.
Okay.
Yeah. We're both in the same MFA program.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Are you also in the first year?
Mm-hmm.
Your MFA? Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Do you have any kind of concentration on...
Yeah, I'm mostly photography.
Yeah. Did you move to Pittsburgh for the program, or were you... Okay, where from?
California.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, the Carnegie is a good program, right?
It's pretty good. It's enjoyable. It's been an interesting first year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great. And what's your name?
I'm Ashley.
Ashley?
Yeah.
I'm Josiah. I teach here
at
Ashton Hill. I teach painting and drawing.
Oh, awesome. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you too. And thank you for coming and, you know,
of
supporting
course.
Your friend. And that's great.
Yeah, she's awesome. And I'm excited to see. I haven't seen this work from her before. Like, I've seen mostly her sculptural things. So seeing these larger installations are really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really excited.
Support her. Yeah, they look great in this space.
Yeah, this is like a good gallery space. It looks really nice. So.
Yes, we have two. This is the small one, and then the bigger one, the Harlem Gallery, just right there. And right now we have a student show.
Okay.
But it's a great gallery. We have these movable walls, like this wall here.
Mm-hmm.
You can move and you know, readjust the gallery space, and I love that we have that flexibility in the space. It's a great place to show.
Yeah, it looks great. Yeah.
Experience.
What are you experiencing right now?
I feel a little damp.
Oh, yeah.
I did look at myself in the mirror and I thought, wet rat. But I'm looking at a fabric piece that's approximately probably 15 feet long by 5, I would say. There's a ladder made out of soft sculpture fabric that protrudes down. There's a lot of objects remade as in soft sculpture and fabrics, different patterns. Some things are coming off the wall. There's a really beautiful spider web made out of chain. And yeah, there's some plasticky fabric that's making up a plant. It's nice.
I think I'm really enjoying seeing these very large installation pieces that I haven't seen yet from Annie's work.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like we're used to seeing some of like the sculptural pieces that she's been working on, but these are so like huge and like magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been appreciative of like her ability to like use different textures and patterns, and but yeah, it feels so very cohesive.
Yeah.
So I'm super happy for her and proud of her.
Yeah.
You know, and how it feels in this space too. Like, this is feels like a really great space to have her work live in as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
It has room to breathe.
Yeah, room to breathe. We also were going to get you flowers, Annie.
Yes, we promise.
We promise we will get you flowers. What's your perspective on navigating an MFA program, but then also trying to build connections within the program? Like, Annie has a solo show. Do you think it's a good idea to, like, pursue building a career or, like, within the program, or just focus on making work?
I think you should only make work.
Okay.
But that's just me. I don't know, I just really valued all like the facilities and space and like the little built-in community of the program, and didn't do very much, put very much effort into leaving the building.
Mm-hmm.
But also like the second half of the program was all like during COVID when I was there.
Oh,
so there was a lot of community, which was great. When did I graduate?
Did you graduate?
2021.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't want to, like, prescribe what everybody should do, but for me, I was very happy to just show up and have it be a time to focus.
Just focus.
On
okay.
myself.
How do you think Annie's doing so far?
She's doing wonderful.
Yeah. Annie is amazing. We love you, Annie. Congrats.
Hi, my name is Penn Shankweiler, and I'm 9 years old.
And I am Morgan Thomas Shankweiler, and this is my interview of one of my twin daughters, Penn. Okay, Penn.
Where do you live?
I live in Pittsburgh.
How do you like Pittsburgh?
It's fine.
Our family moved to Pittsburgh in August so that I could go to grad school at CMU.
What do you like about it?
I like that it's big.
Okay. In what way?
In what way that there are things that I get to explore.
That there's always sort of new things that you haven't seen before. Nice.
I like the parks.
What do you like about the parks?
I like that they're big and have a lot of trees and nature.
I agree.
This radio program is called Is Sound a Language? And is part of the contextual practice component of the MFA program.
I want to ask you about sound. What is your relationship to sound?
Good.
You have a good relationship to sound? Yeah. Do you like sounds?
Sometimes, sometimes.
Okay. So what kind of sounds do you like?
I like nature sounds.
Like what?
Like the wind and the stream rushing and the leaves flapping against each other and the birds chirping.
Nice. What kind of sounds do you not like?
Car sounds, noisy yelling people sounds, people crunching sounds.
Like you don't like the sound of people eating?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a name for that.
What is it?
What's I don't remember name? What it is.
It's misophonia.
And I think I have that too, and I think your grandfather has that too. He hates the sound of people chewing. Especially with their mouth open. You don't like that sound either.
Yeah, I don't like that sound.
Do you like crunching food? Are you bothered by the sound of your own crunching noises in your own mouth?
No.
Me neither. I actually like, I prefer crunchy foods. What is your first memory of sound?
What do you mean?
I mean, if you can think back to when you were really little, do you remember any sounds specifically?
Yeah.
Like what?
Me and my sister fighting.
Really?
Yeah.
That's the sound you remember?
Yeah.
Huh. What did that sound like?
Yeah! But I also remember the wind.
The sound of the wind.
And the rain.
What other sounds do you remember from when you were little?
Dogs.
The sounds of dogs barking.
And lawnmowers.
And leaf blowers. Those are not my favorite sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember any music?
Our family is particularly musical. My father is a cellist and a violin maker, and my husband is a professional singer and conductor. One of my first memories of music is waking up in the morning and hearing my dad playing the cello. All children in our family have always been required to play some sort of musical instrument.
Do you remember any music, or do you not think of music as sound?
I do and I don't. I think it all as sound because you can hear it, but I also don't because I enjoy nature more.
So you actually really like there to be a lot of quiet. Have you ever heard total silence?
Yes, kind of.
Where?
In my room.
Hmm, at night?
Yeah, and also just if I'm sitting there in the morning and it's really quiet in the house.
Do you like that?
Yes, I really like it.
What is your relationship with music now?
I like it, and I also don't like it.
What do you like about it?
I like that it's calming if you're playing it beautifully.
Do you play an instrument?
Yes.
What instrument do you play?
Cello and piano.
Yeah. Why don't you like about it?
That it doesn't always sound calm and beautiful.
You said that there are some sounds that you really don't like, and you said what? Chewing is one. What else?
Cars.
Oh, that's right, cars.
And just the sound of people screaming and making noises and stuff.
When you hear, like, lots of people in a room and they're loud, how does it make you feel?
Overwhelmed.
Yeah. Do you feel like that ever when you're out in nature?
No.
Have you ever been in nature, listening to nature sounds that got really loud?
Yes, but I actually don't mind those nature sounds. I don't mind loud sounds that come from nature.
You said that you don't really like loud noises, but are you a loud person or a quiet person, or both?
Both. I'm a loud person because that's how my dad is, and when I'm happy, I'm loud. Sometimes when I'm sad, I'm loud. But I'm quiet because, I don't know, I just enjoy quietness, and sometimes I just am a quiet person.
Does it help you to focus when you're quiet?
Yes.
Does it help you to calm down if you're in a quiet space?
Yes.
Have you ever listened to the radio?
Yes.
What do you listen to on the radio?
Music. Or if there are weird people talking, the weird people talking.
Weird people talking?
Here, I'm pretty sure she is talking about NPR.
Isn't it funny that now you're a weird person that's going to be talking on the radio?
Yes, but I'm already a weird person.
Speaking of this weird person, Penn had one desire and one desire only for what to talk about on her radio interview.
What do you want to teach me about today or tell me about in this interview?
I want to tell you about armadillos.
Okay, tell me about armadillos.
They're my favorite animal.
Why are they your favorite animal? What do you like about an armadillo?
I like that most people don't have them as their favorite animals. They're kind of another animal that, like, people kind of forget about, and I think they're really cute. I like that they have short, stubby legs, and they kind of are like knights in armor.
That's cool. It is cool that they have their own armor.
If I had an armadillo, I would name it Barney.
Barney?
Yeah.
Barney the armadillo. Okay, so what else do you know about armadillos?
There's only one kind lives in North America. It is the nine-banded armadillo.
Nine-banded? Does that mean it has stripes?
Like the nine bands on the back.
Yeah.
That's what it means.
Got it.
There are 21 kinds of armadillos in all. They live in burrows. They eat insects. Spiders and scorpions, they can smell termites inside a mound. And they use their sticky tongues to grab the food.
That's really cool. I didn't realize they have sticky tongues.
But they use their claws to dig for food.
So they dig, and then they stick their sticky tongues down and grab the bugs?
Mm-hmm. They cannot see well, but their sense of smell is strong.
They don't have good sight, but they have really good smelling and hearing.
They can see things, but it's not.
It's not their best sense.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, they're different than us.
Yes.
In that way. Do you think it's quiet underground?
I think it might be quiet because it's, like, underground and, like, there's nothing there. But I think it might be loud because all the bugs are in there.
It's really cool for me to think about what an area that we aren't in might sound like.
Yeah, well, some armadillos make loud squealing sounds.
Loud squealing sounds? When do they make that sound? Do they? Can armadillos talk to each other? Do armadillos have radio stations?
No!
Do they make radio programs for other armadillos?
No, 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 no.
If you had an armadillo right now, right here, named Barney, what do you think that armadillo would want to say on the radio?
I'm hungry. Or I'm tired.
Why do you think that?
It's the daytime right now and they're nocturnal, so...
Oh, yeah. They'd probably want to be sleeping, huh?
And also, armadillos are shy animals. People try to study them in the wild. In Texas, you can see many places.
Did you know that the word armadillo is Spanish for little armored one? Armadillo.
An armadillo has a carapace for protection. There are about 2,000 scales covering this bone. Bands made of skin connect the parts of the carapace.
Cool. So it actually is kind of like chainmail on a knight. Okay, I think we're almost done. Is there anything else you want to tell us about?
There is an armadillo tale.
Ooh, excellent.
People in South America have a story about an armadillo who was musical. Armadillo loved music. He wished he could sing like the frogs and crickets. A musician told armadillo that his wish would come true, but armadillo would have to wait a long time. After armadillo lived a long and happy life, he died. The musician made his shell into a beautiful instrument. Armadillo sang at last.
Ooh, is there really an instrument made out of armadillo shell?
Probably, but I don't know what.
At this point, a little Google search comes in handy.
Yeah, there is one. It is called the charango. Do you think there's music of the charango somewhere? Let's see. Yeah, you ready? The charango. Which one would you rather listen to? The screaming of an armadillo or the charango?
Actually,
you are listening
like
to this. Is Sound a Language?
Annie Chen. Thank you.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
My name is Logan Larson. Over winter break, I saw the revival of the musical Sunset Boulevard on Broadway. The movie turned musical, and subsequent revivals have a long history, both in their presentations and in the stars that took on the role of Norma Desmond. In case you aren't familiar, the 1950 film Sunset Boulevard centers around a down-and-out writer who stumbles upon the mansion of former silent film star Nora Desmond, who is plotting her revival on screen. She employs the writer to edit a screenplay she hopes will facilitate her big comeback, a depiction of the story of Salome, in which she will play the 16-year-old character. Desmond, a film star of the silent film era, couldn't break into the new medium at the advent of talking pictures. Jaded and haunted by her lost fame, the reality of her situation becomes too real as her obsession over the writer she employs turns deadly after her confession of love for him. Ending with one of the most iconic lines in film history, where Desmond slowly descends the stairs of her mansion and utters the line, "Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up." My interest in Sunset Boulevard emerged after an encounter in the archives at the Harry Ransom Center in Austin, Texas. The Ransom Center holds the archival collection of Gloria Swanson, the actress who originated the role of Desmond in the original Billy Wilder film from 1950. The collection includes 620 boxes of archival materials, almost 292 linear feet of material, which include personal photographs, fan mail, scripts, and related materials from her health foods activism, among a litany of other items. The collection is whispered about by archivists and interns at the Ransom Center because of a notorious object included in the archive, a small, handmade coffin painted green that arrived at the archive filled with sugar. The coffin has the pan-painted text, "Hic jacet Gloria Swanson," or when translated, "Here lies Gloria Swanson," painted on its top. The coffin is rough, obviously quickly made, but is undeniably the thing it aims to represent. The coffin is part of a series of anonymous hate mail sent from the filmmaker Kenneth Anger to Swanson in the late 1970s. Alongside the coffin, other items include a series of annotated postcards which depict cartoon cats engaging in surreal scenarios. These scenes include a wedding, a family photograph, a hair salon, and a moving scene, among a few others. Anger has sequenced them and typed references to moments in Swanson's life directly on the illustrations and added the statement, "This is your life," to the back of each. Then there is also the photograph of her and the actor Rudolph Valentino, stabbed through with pushpins, a glass thermometer, and other sharp objects, operating almost as if it is a voodoo doll. Occasionally, Anger also sent her a series of sugar packets, meant to poke fun at Swanson's health food advocacy and anti-sugar campaigning. Swanson married author William Dufty, who years prior had confronted him about his sugar intake at a cafe when he popped a sugar cube into his coffee. The interaction inspired Dufty to write a book entitled Sugar Blues, dedicated to Swanson, which aimed to reveal the evils of sugar and expose the way sugar is totally immersed in the things we eat. For his final act, after the months-long campaign, Anger revealed himself through a signed headshot, hand-painted with the caption, "For faded glory, season's curses, Anger." On the white border of this photograph, Anger pinned in a curse, which when Googled is revealed to be an occult spell meant to protect against vicious creatures. I'm not sure if Anger is providing a shield against himself to Swanson or the opposite. The headshot accompanied a letter which read, "Vainglorious Lady, odd how in the years since Sunset Boulevard, you have ceased to be Swanson and have become Desmond." Reflections, Kenneth Onger. In this, Onger directly accuses Swanson of becoming her character from Sunset Boulevard. These letters, along with some of the other materials he mailed, were sent with a stamp commemorating the 50th anniversary of Talking Pictures, a direct jab at Swanson's own difficulty making the transition to talking films. An incredibly small detail that Swanson herself may not have even noticed when looking through the mail she received. These are just some of the highlights of items that Onger sent to Swanson. The materials are dramatic, harsh, and mean, of course, but are obviously generated by someone with a deep understanding of this star's personal and professional life. Onger began his hate mail campaign after being sued by Swanson for libel, as she took issue with the characterization Onger attributed to her in his book, Hollywood Babylon. The book and its subsequent sequel present a history of Hollywood's gossip, as Onger alleges to have heard it and experienced it growing up in the early days of Hollywood's golden age. I interpret Onger's anger at Swanson as partially related to his inability to be a film star in his own right. Onger, as a child, starred in the 1935 version of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream and acted in his own films early in his career, but eventually took the helm of directing behind the camera. Swanson was a well-known actress who would have been idolized by Onger, but her litigious rebuttal against him would have corrupted his image of her in his mind. Onger projects his own inability to be a star when tearing down Swanson. My interactions with this archival material resulted in an exhibition and body of work which played with a number of the materials sent by Onger, using facsimiles of some of the archival materials, sugar, and press photographs found on eBay. I also generated a short film, which the exhibition revolved around, entitled The Sugar Coffin. In my ongoing research for these projects, the Broadway musical version of Sunset Boulevard kept popping up in YouTube searches and on Google. Written by Andrew Lloyd Webber, the musical premiered in 1993 on London's West End, and closely follows the contours of the original movie, but now set to song. The production has played host to many divas over the years, including Patti LuPone, who originated the role on the West End, Glenn Close, who famously replaced LuPone when the musical moved to Broadway, and who played the role twice, 25 years apart, and now Nicole Scherzinger of Pussycat Dolls fame in the current revival. This revival is stripped down, removing much of the embellishment and ornamentation of the original film and prior musical, leaving an empty stage populated only by its cast and a set of roving handheld cameras. The revival complicates and plays with the presence of the camera, capturing video that creates an instant feedback loop when projected on a screen at the back of the stage. There is both the acting for the audience present in the room, as well as the attention paid to the camera. I wanted to see this production because of the freedom associated with the revival. The production isn't bogged down in preserving the canon of the reference material. It allows for a new take, free from the weight of its subject matter. It doesn't need the ostentatious house or fake dead monkey to create the sense of place on stage. Scherzinger's version of Norma Desmond was clear and incredible, and she embodied the diva status needed for the role. I was excited to be in a theater with nearly 1,000 people, anxious to witness the hot new thing on stage. On the night I watched the musical in late December 2024, the audience acted as a collective body, and there was a general excitement and seeming anxiety tied to the hope that the performance would live up to the hype. As someone who has listened to the Revival soundtrack over and over, it was exciting to hear and see the nuances of a live version of what had been produced to the nth degree on the album. There was a humanity to the performance, and it was incredibly important that everything was done by a group of humans in front of us. One moment that stuck with me is a near catastrophe that is inherent in live performance. During Scherzinger's rendition of With One Look, one of two main songs where Scherzinger is supposed to embody an otherworldly force and must hold a high note for nearly 10 seconds, Scherzinger flubbed the note. On this night, in the middle of the song, when she sings the word home for 10 seconds, the note went sour, turning mid-word into an off-kilter scream rather than the beautifully rendered version captured on the soundtrack. In the room, the nearly 1,000-person audience tensed up, and one could feel the room hold its breath as we waited to see if Scherzinger could bring the note back into control. The woman next to me even covered her ears as the scream amplified around the room. Scherzinger finished the note and aimed to redeem herself by following up on it with even more force in the following words, reclaiming the stage and the song, leading to thunderous applause at the end of the song. We had witnessed a star fall back to earth and redeem herself, quickly rebuilding the armor she had inadvertently lost for a few seconds. It was all I could hope for in a live performance, and I'm happy I experienced the collective thrill of witnessing a star's rise, partial fall, and an eventual redemption on stage. I think it truly lived up to the ideals of Sunset Boulevard.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
Hello, this is who is a biomedical engineer and an aspiring bio artist. So Joseph, can we talk about how we were just talking earlier about you thinking of yourself as a mutant when you were a child, and that you always knew that you were going to be a scientist? In a similar way that I can relate to that is that I always knew that I would be an artist. So do you want to speak a little more about your early fascination with science?
So when I was a kid, my first grade, I was crying, and I don't quite remember why. I think it was because I didn't have any friends. And I remember this kid came up to me, who would soon be like my best friend, and we're still friends today on Facebook. I haven't seen him in a few years, but he asked me why I was crying, and I said, "Oh, it's because I'm a mutant." And he said, "Well, I'm also a mutant." And there was a school-long friendship formed from that. And when I was that age, I don't know where I got the concept of what a mutant was, or even like what the scientific concept of what a mutant was. And so when people ask me how I knew that I was a scientist, I don't really have a answer. There wasn't like a grand inciting incident about like, oh, I knew that I wanted to pursue therapeutics to cure cancer, or I knew that I wanted to treat neurodegenerative disorders or things like that. I just felt that I was different in some way, and that's why I always felt like I was a scientist.
Okay, I think I can also speak to that in a way that, like, the reason that I always knew that I was an artist is because I would always like do the simple thing in the most weirdest way possible. And that is something that I've continued to do till this day. Like the way that I understand making today is that it's just like the world is just your playground, and you just, you know, give yourself the margin to play around with fields without having any one tag to yourself. That is a very interesting position to be in, and that is what, yeah, that is what being an artist for me is, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so earlier we were also talking about how you think that art and science are the same thing. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, so I came to I came under the impression that art and science were inherently the same thing. And I came here believing that because with art, you are making something that hasn't existed before. And with science, you are studying the theory behind something that hasn't existed before.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're kind of working to an end to make something that hasn't existed before. But during my time here, I realized that there's a pretty hard segregation between the two things for some reason. Now I have more of a science background, and so I remember I talking to various PIs about it, and they didn't consider that art could be science. And I found that, like, really troubling.
Uh-huh.
Because it doesn't really go the other way. I don't think there's people that think science can't be art, but a lot of scientists think art can't be science. And I think mm-hmm. that's very problematic in so many yeah. ways. I think that limits accessibility, that limits creativity, and that is ultimately bad for the advancement of human innovation and technology.
I agree.
Yeah.
But do you think that academia has a lot of part to play in that? Because also, like, Carnegie Mellon is a university famously known for computer science, mm-hmm. which has a art school in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of fosters a certain culture. Like, even as an artist, like, I feel like the corporate vibe of this space just does not let you do much. Like, I come from a very traditional art school, and the way that the spaces are built, they are built for interaction, where you will find artists, like, you know, in every other hallway, or, like, you know, there's, like, certain places that foster a culture of collaboration and interaction, which a space like Carnegie Mellon is, because it's, like, yeah, I mean, I think that this space, just because of the way that it's built, fosters a culture that it is harder to collaborate.
Absolutely. And I think you and me both entered Carnegie Mellon at this kind of, like, adolescent period.
Because,
uh-huh. Like you were saying, Carnegie Mellon is, I believe it's still the number one computer science school in America, and I believe that makes it in the world. And so there's a huge influx of people that are coming to Carnegie Mellon just for the computer science mm-hmm. aspects.
Yeah.
Whereas Carnegie Mellon, to me, like, when I was, like, a teen, was, like, a super big art school, and it was also, like, a big robotics school.
Oh.
And I think right now we're at the kind of precipice where Carnegie Mellon might become more interdisciplinary, mm-hmm. might involve more science and art collaborations in the future, but I think right now there isn't a lot of collaboration, and I think mm-hmm. that is wider academic problem.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily in, like, the bigger, more funded schools, like, say, Harvard.
Uh-huh.
And MIT, in fact, actually has a lot of, like, the MIT Multimedia Lab, in fact, mm-hmm. has a lot of, like, technological and artistic crossovers. But I think in the whole of academia, mm-hmm. there's a pretty big distinction between science and art. And mm-hmm. if one wants to see those collaborations in action, they're gonna have to look more to, like, the private sector and, like, mm-hmm. individual artists outside mm-hmm. of academia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to segue here a little bit and talk about what you said earlier about how, when I said that I, as an artist, feel like I'm obsessed with materiality, and you responded by saying that you feel an aversion to material. Which is an interesting point, because, like, many of the things that we have been talking about in our interactions are very similar, but then when it comes to dealing with material, we have very different approaches. So what is your relationship to materiality?
Well, so when you ask me if I have any materials that I'm obsessed with, my mind immediately snapped to my time as, like, a material scientist,
uh-huh.
Which was kind of a fucking nightmare. Should I swear?
No, okay. But it's okay. We'll cut that out.
Okay. which was kind of a nightmare, because it was kind of, it was a corporate hellscape, and it was a lot of heavy chemistry. And while it was a stable job and paid the bills, I really despised it because it was a lot of, not even hard science, it was a lot of ratio mixing and then troubleshooting and then processing for scale up. And so when I think of materials from a scientific perspective, I think of that job. And so I never, ever want to go back to that mindset I had when thinking about materials. Now, as an artist, I don't have a particular material that I'm obsessed with, at least not yet. I'm sure there might be phases in my life where I swap to something or form an interest in something. But I don't believe that I'll ever have like a lifelong interest in a certain material. And I kind of hope that I don't.
Okay. The reason that I am very interested in this question of materiality is because, like, I feel like, you know, we have spoken about this, about the fact that art and science at the heart of it can be thought of as one thing. And I do think that materiality becomes that very thing that leads these things, like that joins art and science being one thing. But just the approaches towards that then become point of difference.
Yes.
Because we deal with the ideas of, and questions of representation. Whereas you deal with the functionality of it more than, you know, any ethical, moral, or, you know, political questions around what that thing is.
Precisely.
You have a more function, like, your relationship to words, it is more practical. And it also, and that's, I think, the point where you are very critical of science is because, you know, it doesn't, it always is serving into a corporate framework where it has to be profitable.
Precisely, and that's why I don't think I liked my time as a material scientist, is because it was all very profit driven, it was all very pragmatic, and it all served a means to an end, however granular it might have been. And it had to be particularly granular because it had to be safe so that it couldn't be wildly experimental, because it couldn't shake up the industry too much. And it had to be profitable. And so it had to be small incremental baby steps forward for the sake of profitability. And while I think there should be a kind of temperance of the advancement of science, particularly in biosciences, I think the temperance of the advancement of science for profitability, for marketability, is stifling, absolutely stifling.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it, I think both artists and scientists believe that the world could be a better place.
100%.
Yes. And, I don't know, that's an interesting thought. Maybe there's, maybe there's a scientist and an artist who think the world could be a worse place, and they work towards it. But, artists and scientists believe the world could be a better place.
Yeah.
And I think when you see that the world's areas where the world could be a better place, and you see that it's just not happening, it can be very frustrating. It can be very consuming to your soul.
Hey, kids. It's Krusty the Clown. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. All right, where's my money? What? Ah, chintzy college stations.
We can secure our world when you choose your passwords. Make them strong. Use a password manager to help you along.
Learn how to use strong passwords at cisa.gov/secure-our-world.
Hey, look, everyone, it's Mando.
Everybody ready?
Well, hello there, everybody, and welcome to another relaxing episode of Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio, or the Roots program, depending on where you are listening. I am Mando Richard, and I don't know if this is going to be a relaxing episode or not. We'll see. We got a Lick It Up set, a folk rock set, and a gospel set, and all the usual fun music, old and new. Let's see, what are we going to start with? Oh, here comes one of my favorite songs of 2019 from Marian Halliday.
Thrown in. I like the things that make me burn and sweat. Hard living with no regrets. Oh, my aching head. Why's that bottle in my bed? I like the things that aren't good for me. I like you and Kentucky whiskey. Thoughts to hold me tight.